introduction. I first wanted to thank the organizers of the workshop. This is a very nice workshop that brings lots of different and exciting things together. I'm going to talk about ideal tetrahedra and their duals. I should maybe warn you before, it's not strictly speaking quantum gravity, it's more like geometry that could be useful for quantum gravity. And what I'm talking about is all joint work with Carlos Carinzi, who is based at the Korea Institute of Advanced Study. The main reference is this preprint. The other article is more kind of the background and motivation, but the preprint is basically the content of my talk. Okay, I'll start by explaining what ideal tetrahedra are and why they're useful. Then I'll go on to explain why one might be interested in their duals in view of 3D gravity. And then I'll explain about the work. Okay, let's start with the ideal tetrahedra. So at first, ideal tetrahedra are ideal hyperbolic tetrahedra. These are geodesic tetrahedra in three-dimensional hyperbolic space. That means all the faces of the tetrahedra are totally geodesic planes, the edges are geodesics, and then there's what's special about them and why they're called ideal. All the vertices are at the boundary of the hyperbolic space, which can be identified with the Riemann sphere or with C unified with a point at infinity. So let's look what this looks like concretely. One can use several models for hyperbolic space. Here I use the upper half space model. So we are just in R3 and we consider the set of points that have the z coordinate greater than zero with the hyperbolic metric. And if one looks at this hyperbolic metric, one can work out the geodesics. And the geodesics are half circles and lines that are orthogonal at this boundary plane. And one should take care, the point at infinity is also there, so this is the point that goes up. So an ideal tetrahedron can look either like this or like this. This looks quite different, but this is just from drawing it, so the point infinity is not special in any way. It's just like any other point at the boundary. So here the edges are geodesics, here one sees the faces, and here there's just one point that's infinitely far away. Okay. So one is interested in these ideal tetrahedra, but one is not interested in, well, one is only interested up to isometries. So if we have an isometry that acts on this tetrahedron, it sends it to another one, we only consider them up to isometries. And the isometry group of the three-dimensional hyperbolic space is isomorphic to the group PSL2C, and it acts on this boundary by Möbius transformations. So that's just the standard action of PSL2C by Möbius transformation, and that moves the vertices of this ideal tetrahedron. Of course, one might consider other tetrahedra that have the vertices inside of the hyperbolic space, but the ideal ones have quite special properties. Okay. The first one is they're determined up to the isometries by their cross ratio. So this is the usual cross ratio in the Riemann sphere, or C with the point at infinity. So one just takes the vertices and forms the cross ratio, and that determines it completely. Another way of describing them is by their dihedral angles. So dihedral angles are just angles between the faces of the tetrahedron. So every edge has a dihedral angle because there are two faces meeting there. And the ideal tetrahedron has fewer than one might think, so a priori it could have 6, but it has only 2. So here I have given 3, but they add up to pi, so there are only 2 of them are independent. And why is this? Well, in the ideal tetrahedron, the angles between at the opposite edges, they're equal. So here we have an edge with angle alpha, this is the opposite edge, it has also alpha, then we have beta, and then we have gamma. And of course I could draw it also here, but there's less space. So they have a higher degree of symmetry than standard hyperbolic tetrahedra, and they're just determined by very few parameters. Okay, how can one see this? Basically by using the isometries. So the isometry group acts on hyperbolic space and on its boundary. And by using this isometry action, I can send 3 of the vertices to kind of fixed reference points where one usually takes infinity, 0, and 1. So this is now in complex numbers, and then the fourth one lands somewhere else, and this is kind of characterized by number z, and this is precisely the cross ratio. And this is the usual three transitivity of the Möbius transformations. Then one can also parameterize this remaining complex number z in terms of real parameters, alpha, beta, and gamma, and in this way one gets the dihedral angles. What is special about the tetrahedron, the ideal hyperbolic tetrahedron, is that it's much simpler than a standard tetrahedron and it has a very simple formula for the volume. So this is often credited to Lobachevsky. It was first given in specifically this form only by Milnor in a review article, but Lobachevsky basically laid the groundwork. And here one sees the volume is a function of the dihedral angles. And what comes up there is the so-called Clausen function, or classical dilogarithm, or Lobachevsky function. So here I give it in terms of the Clausen function. That's given by integrating the logarithm of the absolute value of some sign. You can also see it as the imaginary part, or related to the imaginary part of the so-called classical dilogarithm, or you can also call it Lobachevsky function. And these are functions that are important also in number theory, in all kinds of parts of mathematics. And the dilogarithm is important because it also defines modular invariance. So this is much simpler than the volume formula for a general tetrahedron, which can be a terrible mess. And this comes from the higher degree of symmetries. Okay, so they're nice, but what does one do with them? So why they're important in mathematics is because they're used in hyperbolic geometry. So what one can do is to define hyperbolic structures on manifolds by decomposing them in ideal tetrahedra. So what one does is one takes a three-manifold, just a topological one with a boundary, one triangulates it in such a way that all the vertices lie at the boundary, and then one assigns to the tetrahedra in this triangulation ideal tetrahedra. And then I have to ensure that they glue together neatly, so I have to impose gluing conditions. And these gluing conditions are simple. They basically say that if I glue tetrahedra around an edge, the dihedral angle must add up to 2 pi, and then I have another condition for the singularity later. And in this way, one can construct hyperbolic structures on knot complements, and generally also computer volumes, because the volume is then just given by the volumes of the ideal tetrahedra. So this is very important in hyperbolic geometry. And recently, it has been generalized, like in the last 5 years, from hyperbolic space to two other spaces. So there is now a concept of ideal tetrahedron, not just in hyperbolic space, but also in three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, and a space that is often called half-pipe space or Kominkowski space. That is a space that has basically two Euclidean directions and one that is degenerate. And there one has an analogous concept of ideal tetrahedron, and one can kind of generalize this construction for the construction of the hyperbolic structures and construct anti-de Sitter and half-pipe structures. And what is more important for the people looking at it, one can construct so-called geometric transitions between hyperbolic structures, anti-de Sitter structures, and half-pipe structures. But one cannot compute the volumes here because there's no general volume formula yet. Okay, so this explains why the hyperbolic ideal tetrahedra are important in mathematics. So the question is, why are they important in quantum gravity? And why are the duals important? And the duals are important because they have applications in 3D gravity. So I don't have much time to say much about 3D gravity. Just the most important points. So in three dimensions, the Einstein equations look like in any dimension, but what is special is that the vacuum solutions have constant curvature. Not just constant Ricci curvature, but constant sectional or Riemann curvature. There are no local gravitational degrees of freedom, so no gravitational waves there, just a finite number of global degrees of freedom from the topology of the spacetime. There are also black hole solutions in anti-de Sitter space, and so on. I will not talk about those. Okay, but any of these vacuum solutions is locally isometric either to three-dimensional de Sitter, Minkowski, or anti-de Sitter space. And what distinguishes these spaces that are important in 3D gravity is these are precisely the spaces that are dual to the spaces that have the ideal tetrahedra. So 3D de Sitter space is dual to the three-dimensional hyperbolic space. Minkowski is dual to co-Minkowski or half-pipe space. And Anti de Sitter is dual to itself. Okay, so why does one look specifically at tetrahedra? Well, 3D gravity is important as a toy model for quantum gravity in higher dimensions. So one wants to study the quantization of gravity in this model. And there are many approaches. Like some approaches come from the relation of 3D gravity to Chern-Simons theory that goes back to Witten. Then there are other approaches. Many of them are based on tetrahedra. So there are so-called state sum models or spin form models that go back to Ponsano and Retzsche and that have been very successfully formulated also for quantum groups to define quantum invariants of three manifolds. But they can be viewed as kind of the state sum models for Euclidean quantum gravity. Then of course there's Retzsche calculus, then there are things like causal dynamical triangulations, and many of them are based on triangulations, tetrahedra, and so on. So it's certainly a good idea to understand the geometry of the tetrahedra in three-dimensional de Sitter, Minkowski, and anti-de Sitter space, and also to ask, are there some particularly nice tetrahedra that are nice in the same way as the ideal hyperbolic tetrahedra are nice? So it's particularly simple with a higher degree of symmetry, something one can use as building blocks. And then, of course, one would also like to understand volumes. That's something one likes to understand in general in 3D gravity or in higher dimensional gravity, and here one should relate it to these volumes of tetrahedra. Then one could also say one doesn't like the formalisms that put in already the tetrahedra from the beginning, but it comes up nevertheless, even if one works with a different formalism. So another approach to 3D gravity is to use Teichmüller theory and hyperbolic geometry. So under some causality assumptions, which are reasonable, they say basically one looks at globally hyperbolic spacetimes with a fixed Cauchy surface, that is a surface of genus G, should be geodesically complete, one can give a full classification of the three-dimensional spacetimes. So one looks at one fixes kind of topologically the Cauchy surface S, and then one looks at maximal globally hyperbolic Lorentz metrics in three dimensions that have a fixed curvature lambda and have S as a complete Cauchy surface, and one looks at them up to diffeomorphisms that are isotopic to the identity. And that gives one a moduli space of three-dimensional globally hyperbolic spacetimes. And this moduli space can be viewed as the phase space of 3D gravity, and it can be related also to other spaces from Teichmüller theory that are kind of well studied and well understood. Like first, one can relate it to the cotangent bundle of Teichmüller space. One can also relate it to the space of measured geodesic laminations over the surface. And one can, of course, then use all the tools and all the insights that one has about Teichmüller space and its cotangent bundle, about measured geodesic laminations, to investigate this moduli space. So basically, here we have an explicit parametrization of the phase space of 3D gravity, which can be viewed kind of like a Hamiltonian approach to describe the phase space and then to quantize it. And it's formulated in terms of mathematical structures that are well understood. One can say more. One can relate the spacetimes via so-called Wick rotations to certain domains in hyperbolic space. One can also construct spacetimes by using constructions from hyperbolic geometry, namely the so-called earthquake and grafting construction. So the constructions are due to Thurston, but they were first applied to 3D gravity by Mess. And one can also use other tools, for instance, one can use something like generalized shear coordinates that mimic the shear coordinates on Teichmüller space to describe these moduli spaces. And this is basically what brought us to investigate the ideal tetrahedra and their duals, because we looked at this and we found that we can give explicit description of the mapping class group action, and this mapping class group action expressions were related to the volumes of ideal tetrahedra. So we wondered why, because we're working in spaces like Minkowski space and so on, why should this be related? And this was basically the starting point where we started looking at this. Okay, so this is the reason why one is interested, or why we were interested in the ideal tetrahedra and in their duals. Okay, now I'm going to talk about this more concretely. I'll say explicitly what the spaces are that we are considering, what the tetrahedra look like, what are the properties. So basically, we have a triple of spaces that are the spaces for 3D gravity. I'll call them 3D Lorentzian spaces in the following. And then we have a triple of spaces that carry ideal tetrahedra. I'll call them ideal spaces. Okay, so the Lorentzian spaces are de Sitter space, Minkowski space, and anti-de Sitter space. The dual spaces are the hyperbolic space, so-called half-pipe space, and anti-de Sitter space. And they belong to lambda is equal to 1, lambda 0, and lambda is equal to minus 1. We can, in principle, consider all the values of lambda, but it just makes the formulas messier. So normally, I restrict attention to that. Here, in the Lorentzian spaces, lambda is the curvature, and in the ideal spaces, lambda is the signature. So what I mean by it is hyperbolic space is Euclidean, signature plus, plus, plus. Half-pipe space has a degenerate direction, and anti-de Sitter space is Lorentzian. Okay, so one can also look at the spaces concretely, and the easiest way to realize them is to consider a sort of ambient space where one can embed them. So one just considers R4 with a bilinear form that depends on the cosmological constant or signature lambda. So one coordinate here depends, so in the bilinear form, one sees how this one coordinate is kind of enters with lambda. Okay. So then we can realize all the ideal spaces as kind of a set of time-like vectors in this ambient space up to rescaling. So time-like means that if I put them into this bilinear form twice, I get something that is smaller than zero, and here I rescale with real numbers that are not equal to zero. And there's a similar picture, although slightly different, for the Lorentzian spaces. What one sees here is the signature changes, but again, they're just certain vectors that are either time-like or they are light-like. Here I have a degenerate condition up to rescaling. So these are all spaces that are contained, and they're all equipped with the induced matrix. And they're contained in the real projective space of dimension 3. So this is basically just a unified parametrization, but it's the standard parametrization one can give of anti-de Sitter, de Sitter, and Minkowski space, and of these duals. Okay. Now, if I want to have ideal tetrahedra, I need a boundary, an asymptotic boundary, or boundary at infinity. And this is described in a similar way, only here I don't take the time-like vectors, but I take the light-like vectors up to rescaling. Okay, then there's a sort of duality between the spaces. This duality identifies points with geodesic planes in the other, geodesics with geodesics, and geodesic planes with points. One can also describe it quite explicitly. So basically, if I have, so this brackets here denote the rescaling equivalence class. So if I have a rescaling equivalence class of a point x in a Lorentzian space, I consider something that would be for lambda not equal to zero, just the orthogonal complement and intersected with the dual space. So here it's just the orthogonal complement intersected with the dual. For lambda is equal to zero, I have a degenerate metric here. And there something goes wrong with the orthogonal complement. One can see this as a regularization, and it's justified via certain blow-up procedures. And of course, the duality I can take in the same way. I can take a rescaling equivalence class of a point in the ideal space, and then I get a plane in the Lorentzian space. So this can be made pretty explicit, and that's basically the situation there. Okay, we didn't work with that description, but we had to simplify the description also to give a unified description of the tetrahedra and to compute their volumes and to identify them, and we worked instead with matrices. So basically, we considered something that can be viewed as a generalization of the complex numbers. So basically, for lambda is equal to 1, this gives the complex numbers. For lambda is equal to 0, it gives the so-called dual numbers. And for lambda is equal to minus 1, it gives the hyperbolic numbers. They go back to the time of Gauss. And of course, here, for lambda not equal to 1, one does not have number fields. They're just commutative rings or two-dimensional algebras over the reals. But you can handle them in pretty much the same way as complex numbers. So we can parameterize these numbers in terms of a real part x, an imaginary part. Here we don't have I squared is equal to minus 1. We have I squared is equal to, which is called L, is equal to minus 1, 0, or to 1. And we can form real part, imaginary part. We can complex conjugate in the usual way. It's just the only difference is that not every element has a multiplicative inverse. Okay. And what we can also do is we can analytically continue some functions that are analytic on some subset of the reals. We can analytically continue them to this kind of generalized complex numbers. Okay, the second ingredient we need is the matrices. So we consider the two-dimensional matrices, 2x2 matrices with entries in this commutative ring, and we define two involutions. The first one is basically almost like taking the inverse of a matrix of determinant 1 and complex conjugating. And the second one is just the usual Hermitian adjoint. So I conjugate, complex conjugate, I take the transpose, and I take the, Okay. I think the minus is here. The minus here is not correct. Okay. So we take these two involutions, and then we can describe, in principle, all the spaces in terms of matrices. So the Lorentzian spaces and the ideal spaces are just the set of positive determinant matrices that are Hermitian with respect to these two involutions up to rescaling. And we can parameterize them explicitly, and these are precisely the coordinates from the last slide. And then one just needs to do a few computations and sees that it agrees. We can describe the metrics in terms of the determinants of the matrices or their imaginary part. We can describe pretty much everything else. So the isometry group is just a set of matrices that have a positive determinant have determinant 1 up to plus minus 1, so we can just write it as PSL2C lambda. But depending on what lambda is, these are very different groups. So we have PSL2C lambda is just the group PSL2C. For lambda is equal to 1, then it's PSL2R times PSL2R. For lambda is equal to minus 1, and it's the Poincaré group in three dimensions for lambda is equal to 0. So they have quite different properties, but they can nevertheless be described in a common framework. Okay, then when the group acts on the spaces just by Hermitian conjugation with respect to the two involutions. The geodesics one can parameterize in terms of in terms of the exponential map. So we exponentiate imaginary multiples of elements of SL2R, and then we act on them with isometries. So the geodesic from the unit matrix are just given by the exponential of imaginary elements, and the other ones I get by acting on the isometries. And the geodesic is space-like, time-like, or light-like, depending on the determinant of this SL2R element. And geodesic planes can be parameterized in a similar way. Just here I have to take two linearly independent elements on each side. And equivalently, I can describe them in terms of a normal vector, which is again a matrix that is just orthogonal on these elements. So there's a concept of a normal vector. The ideal boundary here is just the set of matrices that has determinant 0 and that is Hermitian up to rescaling. And one can wonder about the dual, and one finds that the dual of these are light-like geodesic planes in these Lorentzian spaces. So they're geodesic planes that contain light-like but no time-like geodesics. Okay, so this was rather technical, but this was just to make a link between the more abstract description in terms of the matrices and the explicit parametrization of anti-de Sitter, de Sitter space, and Minkowski space that maybe everyone knows. So in principle, here one just to summarize, we can describe everything in a very neat way in matrices, where we don't have to consider the cases separately. We just get one formula for all the different values of lambda. We can parameterize things very nicely and explicitly, and this is of course important to look at the geometry of the tetrahedra. Okay, so that's basically the description, and now we can think about the generalized ideal tetrahedra. So the generalized ideal tetrahedron in these kind of ideal spaces is defined just like the ideal tetrahedron in hyperbolic space, up to one additional condition. So one says it's a geodesic three simplex, so the faces are geodesic planes, the edges are geodesics, and so on, and the vertices are supposed to be at the boundary, which is defined in exactly the same way for all the spaces. There's only one additional condition. I don't admit for the vertices just any vertices on the boundary, but I ask that these boundary vertices are pairwise connected by space-like geodesics. So in the hyperbolic case, this is no restriction because basically it's Euclidean and every geodesic is space-like, so this does not restrict where the boundary points are, but it's a restriction in the anti-de Sitter case and in the half-pipe space case. And we'll see later what this means and where it comes from. So this is the definition of the ideal tetrahedron. And it has then been shown by Danziger that an ideal tetrahedron in these kind of generalized spaces is determined up to isometries by a generalized cross ratio or generalized dihedral angles. So here I give just two of them because the third one depends on them. And I also work with exterior angles. And the reason is the same as in the hyperbolic case. So one just considers the action of the isometry group on the boundary, and one sends the vertices to certain standard vertices that replace infinity, 0, and 1. They're just these matrices. Then for the last vertex, one cannot choose it freely. And for the last vertex, one has a parameter, a generalized complex number that tells you where it is. And this parameter can again be parametrized, as we did for the hyperbolic tetrahedron, in terms of dihedral angles, or generalized dihedral angles. The only difference is, before, there were always signs in the parametrization, and now we work with a generalized sign that is either just the function f of x is equal to x, or it's the sign, or it's the hyperbolic sign. Okay, and in this way, one can describe the ideal, generalized ideal tetrahedron. And we used this description of the generalized ideal tetrahedron to compute the volume. Basically, what we did is we parametrized it in a unified way, and then we could generalize the volume computation for the ideal tetrahedra. What we found is the volume takes the same expression essentially as before. The only difference is that these kind of Clausen functions or Lobachevsky functions are now replaced by a generalized Clausen or Lobachevsky function. Here I should say something about how volume is defined in the half-pipe space case, because it's degenerate, it has a degenerate metric. And the notion of volume we use is it's the unique three form that is invariant under the isometry group. That determines it up to a rescaling, a global rescaling, and the rescaling is determined by the condition that we have a good limit where lambda goes to zero. So this is defined also in the degenerate case. And one sees the volume of this generalized ideal tetrahedra as essentially just the deformation of the old volume formula, and they can be computed in exactly the same way. Okay, so much about the generalized ideal tetrahedra. Now one can also consider the duals. And the picture is one has these ideal spaces, and one has the Lorentzian spaces. So now the vertices of the ideal tetrahedron are a point on the boundary here, and that corresponds via duality to a light-like geodesic plane. Then the edges that connect two vertices, they are required to be space-like by definition, They're dual to a space-like geodesic. And here, the space-like geodesic is just the intersection of the two light-like planes. And this explains, in a certain way, also the space-like condition for the ideal tetrahedra, because if I intersect two light-like planes, I always get a space-like geodesic here, and that forces me to ask for space-like geodesics here. And finally, the faces of the ideal tetrahedron are dual to the intersection point of three light-like planes. And three light-like planes in these spaces, if they intersect pairwise, they always intersect in a common point, and this intersection point is precisely then the vertex. And basically, this condition on the generalized ideal tetrahedra that was imposed ad hoc in the definition just states that the dual have to have vertices. So we can understand it from the dual tetrahedra. It's just saying a generalized tetrahedron should have a dual, and that precisely asks that these vertices are connected by space-like edges. Okay. Then one can define, of course, a light-like tetrahedron in just the same way as before one could define the ideal tetrahedron. So light-like tetrahedron is simply a geodesic three simplex, so the faces are totally geodesic planes, the edges are geodesics, in these Lorentzian spaces such that the faces are light-like geodesic planes. So just the tetrahedron that has light-like faces. All light-like faces. And now one can look at the geometry of these light-like tetrahedra and compare them also with the geometry of ideal tetrahedra. So the first thing is one can now work explicitly with the duality and see by explicit computations that such a light-like tetrahedron here is indeed dual to the ideal tetrahedron in these ideal spaces. And one can find also that the light-like tetrahedra are determined up to isometries by two real parameters that kind of generalize the dihedral angles, or are dual to the dihedral angles of the ideal tetrahedra. And the proof is again pretty much the same. One uses the isometry group action now on these Lorentzian spaces to bring the vertices into a standard position. Equivalently, I can say I bring the normal vectors of these faces of the light-like tetrahedron in a standard position and then compute the vertices. But one sees, if one does this, one gets a rather simple expression, so I can always assure that one vertex is the identity matrix and the other two vertices are parametrized in terms of exponentials of something imaginary and the kind of dual angles, alpha, beta, and then their sum. Yeah, and then I just insert it into the duality and I see that this is dual to the generalized ideal tetrahedra and the standard parametrization. Okay. Now the properties of the light-like tetrahedra are kind of dual to the properties of the ideal hyperbolic tetrahedra. So we can use this explicit parametrization to analyze their properties and we see what we get. So first property is if we have a light-like tetrahedron, the edges are always space-like. This is because two light-like planes, if they intersect at all, they intersect in a space-like edge. Then we find that opposite edges have equal length. And these lengths are given by alpha beta and alpha plus beta. So here we have the opposite edges, and one sees the pairwise have the same length. What one also sees is one has a sort of distinguished pair of longest edges of length alpha plus beta, and one sees that the dihedral angles of the ideal tetrahedron have become the edge length of the light-like tetrahedron, which makes kind of sense because one often has a duality where angles in one picture become length in another, and this is what one sees here. Then one can look at the properties of this tetrahedra in more detail. One can find, for example, that the midpoints of the longest edges are not only distinguished by the longest edges are not only distinguished by the length, but also by the causality. These midpoints are connected by a time-like geodesic, and it has maximum arc length. Now if one looks at the other edge pairs, then one finds that if one takes the geodesic that connects a point on this edge and on this edge, or in the other way around here, then these edges are always space-like. Finally, one can also look at precisely the distances and the angles and so on, and one finds, for instance, that the midpoint of the longest edges and the opposite vertices, they always form an equilateral triangle, and you can compute the edge length of this triangle. So they have a very high degree of symmetry and nice geometrical properties. One might ask now, I mean, how common are they? Is this something extremely exotic to have a light-like tetrahedron, or is this something very standard? How many of them are there? How can I kind of count them? And the answer is they're pretty standard. So here's the triangle. One can barely see it. They're pretty standard because in the situation where lambda is positive or zero, the light-like tetrahedra, they correspond one-to-one to triples of pairs of non-coplanar space-like geodesics. So it's clear if I have a light-like tetrahedron, then the edges are space-like, and I have three pairs of edges, namely the three pairs of opposite edges. These are space-like edges, and they're not contained in a common plane, because otherwise the tetrahedron would be degenerate. So basically, every tetrahedron defines a triple of pairs of non-coplanar space-like geodesic. So just two space-like geodesics that don't intersect and that are not parallel. Conversely, one can ask, given such a triple or given any kind of set of non-coplanar space-like geodesics, do I get a light-like tetrahedron? And the answer is yes, at least if lambda is equal to 1 or 0. So what I can do, if I have these two non-coplanar space-like geodesics, then for each of them, there's a unique pair of light-like planes that intersects in these geodesics. If I have two of them, then I have four light-like planes, and then one sees, by checking, that the geodesic always intersects the light-like planes of the other one, and in this way, one forms an light-like tetrahedron. So if lambda is equal to minus 1, this is not completely true. There one needs to impose a sort of condition on the space-like geodesics. This condition has to do with the relative, basically what one would say, the angle between the velocity vectors of the geodesics and the distance of the geodesics. But it's still true if this condition is satisfied. So basically, one can also see the light-like tetrahedra as just pairs of space-like geodesics. And that tells you that it's not something incredibly exotic or difficult to construct, but something that is rather common. Yes, and this list of properties shows in principle that they are very much like the ideal tetrahedra, only that everything is kind of in the dual picture. So here I have formulas for the edge length instead of formulas for the angles. Opposite edges are always have equal length instead of opposite edges have equal dihedral angles. And everything translates very nicely in the dual picture. So that means they have properties that are almost equally nice as of the ideal tetrahedra. Okay. So one of the main things we wanted to investigate with that was about the volumes of the light-like tetrahedra. Volume, again, in the same sense as before, there's a unique three form that is invariant under the isometries of the spaces in question, and that we take as the volume form, and that fixes the volume kind of up to a constant. And this constant we fix by saying that we want to have a well-defined limit where lambda goes to zero. So the question is, can one compute the volumes of the light-like tetrahedra? And in general, volume computations are very difficult. Like volume computation in curved spaces like de Sitter or anti-de Sitter space are prohibitively difficult, and there are very few general results. There are also very few general results for non-ideal hyperbolic tetrahedra. The volume gets very complicated. So I've only given the nicest formula for the ideal hyperbolic tetrahedra, which looks as if it's manageable, but generally it's a very difficult problem. But here again, one can hope the light-like tetrahedra have fewer parameters than a general tetrahedron in these spaces. They have a much higher degree of symmetry, so one can hope that maybe the volume formulas can be derived and get manageable in the same way that this is true for the hyperbolic ideal tetrahedra. And it's still not easy to compute the volume, but one can give a volume computation if one, but not by brute force. So one really needs to take into account the geometry of the tetrahedra. If one just tries to feed it into Mathematica, then this gives some terrible integrals over Appel's hypergeometric functions, and one cannot compute a sensible formula for the volume. So this is not something one can resolve by brute force. This is only something one can resolve by geometry and by parametrizing it in a nice way. Okay, but we found after a long time that we could indeed compute these volumes of the light-like tetrahedra, just as we can compute the volumes of the ideal tetrahedra. And what we get is a formula that consists of two parts. So the first part is exactly the formula for the volume of the ideal tetrahedron. So if I have a light-like tetrahedron with edge length alpha, beta, and alpha plus beta, it has a dual ideal tetrahedron, and the first term in the volume formula is just the volume of the dual ideal tetrahedron. And then there's a second part, which is a combination of logarithms and kind of generalized sine functions. And one sees again it has the same pattern, so we have a term for alpha, for beta, for alpha plus beta. And if one looks at the definition of this generalized Clausen function, one sees this is basically involves the derivatives of these Clausen functions, always multiplied with the edge length. And then one has a term 1 over lambda. One might worry about what happens with this 1 over lambda term if we let lambda go to 0, but I'll show you that it's okay. Okay, so what one sees here is basically a quite simple formula that again uses only these kind of generalized Clausen functions, and is just the volume of the dual plus some additional term. And this additional term has a nice form, and it's something that reminds very strongly of Schläfli formulas. So Schläfli formulas are expected if one deals with special types of tetrahedra and certain duals, but usually in a Euclidean context and not something like this. It's also not exactly a Schläfli formula, but it reminds very much of them. Okay. So one might ask two questions. The first question is this well-defined if lambda goes to zero? Because we have the lambda here. And the second question is, okay, at least in one case, namely if lambda is zero, I'm in Minkowski space, my tetrahedron should have a very simple volume formula, which should be just 1/3 times the edge length. So somehow this should appear, or this would be wrong. And one finds that indeed one can develop this volume formula in terms of a power series. So this is kind of special because one could try to develop the volume of the ideal tetrahedron, so only this first part of the volume in a power series. And one would find if I try to do this in lambda is equal to zero, I just get the Laurent series, I don't get the power series. There are some problems with the log and it gets unpleasant. But here one has a very nice power series development. And these coefficients B2k are just the Bernoulli numbers. So one can develop this as a power series in lambda and in alpha and beta. And then one can, of course, consider what happens if lambda goes to zero. And one finds that this gives 1/3 alpha beta times alpha plus beta. That would be the usual volume for a tetrahedron in Euclidean or in Minkowski space in terms of the edge length. And here one gets higher order terms that depend only on the curvature. So in principle, this goes very nicely. And one finds one has some dual tetrahedra that have nice properties that are kind of distinguished in Minkowski space and in De Sitter space and in anti-De Sitter space. And one can compute their volume in a unified way and in a straightforward way. And they're also kind of special from the causality perspective because they're distinguished by the fact that all their faces are light-like. Okay. So now I come to the conclusions and to other questions that come up and to future things that should be done. So we have a unified description of these generalized ideal tetrahedra and of the dual light-like tetrahedra. And we can use this description and our understanding of the geometry to compute some simple and unified volume formulas, which is something that is really hard in general. Okay, so the question about what one can do with this, or what we plan to do with this. So what interests us at the moment is we want to use these formulas to describe the mapping class group action on these kind of modulized spaces of maximal globally hyperbolic spacetimes of constant curvature. So in these modulized spaces, one can describe them in terms of triangulations. So one has data associated to a triangulation, or one can go into the dual picture. And the action of a mapping class group on the triangulation is given by the so-called flip move, where one takes two adjacent triangles and flips the diagonal. And here this gives a picture that flips this kind of to this. And if one looks at this picture, one would say already, okay, this looks as if I'm gluing a tetrahedron. So here are two sides of my tetrahedra, and I glue like a tetrahedron on top, and then the diagonal changes to this. And here it's basically the same, but in the dual picture. And we want to understand if these mapping class group actions that we know come up, if we can describe them in terms of gluing ideal tetrahedra or gluing dual light-like tetrahedra. And this is not something finished, it's some preliminary results, but we find that we can indeed do that, and it gives us the formulas. This can work if we describe this modulized space in terms of generalized shear coordinates, so it's data associated to the triangulation, and we get a picture that we get the mapping class group action by gluing ideal or light-like tetrahedra. So here we have to work with the general tetrahedra because we are not really looking at the full space, we are just looking at the general tetrahedra. But what one also sees is that somehow this dual picture that here one says, well, it's just combinatorially taking the dual, has some interpretation in terms of the tetrahedra. So if I want to glue ideal tetrahedra, I glue them in a way that I say, well, okay, I glue a face of this tetrahedron on a face of the triangulation, or I glue several faces, but whatever I do, I glue them along the faces. And then I get some conditions that give me a consistency conditions on the angles between the faces. For the light-like tetrahedra, it's not so sensible to glue them along the faces, because what happens in the light-like case, I cannot define the angles between the faces. The faces are light-like planes, so they have no angles, and it's not to be expected if I glue along the faces that I can get some kind of well-defined formula for dihedral angles. Also, they do not have dihedral angles, what I have is just edge length. And in this way, one can see that this picture is the dual picture. So here I'm also gluing a tetrahedron, and this tetrahedron is in here. I don't glue the tetrahedra by the faces, but I glue them along the vertices. So if I have a tetrahedron here, so this maybe continues here, and then what I can do is I can prolong the edges, and then there's another tetrahedron here. And what I get is some condition on the edge side. So here I have alpha, beta, gamma. Here I have alpha prime, beta prime, gamma prime. And I will get some gluing condition on the edge length. And this makes perfect sense because they have well-defined edge length, but no well-defined angles. The other ones have well-defined angles, but all their edges have infinite length in the hyperbolic case. So this translates into a dual gluing. And we understand some things about the mapping class group action, but we don't understand it fully yet. Then, what I also think could be interesting is that in higher dimensions, there's kind of a similar picture. So again, I have some Lorentzian spaces that are kind of the homogeneous spaces of constant curvature, homogeneous isotropic constant curvature given by the cosmological constant. This is, of course, again, de Sitter, Minkowski, and anti-de Sitter space. And there are also kind of dual ideal spaces, namely the n-dimensional hyperbolic space, something that is like an n-dimensional half-pipe space, and something that is like an n-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So this has been considered a little bit in the mathematics literature, these spaces on the right-hand side. But basically, one can just imagine the same definitions as in three dimensions. One goes one dimension higher, One defines the de Sitter, Minkowski and anti de Sitter space as one is used to, and one defines these kind of dual spaces also the way one did in three dimensions and the way one is used to. And again, one will find that the light-like n-simplices in these Lorentzian spaces will be dual to the ideal n-simplices. This is simply because ideal points on the boundary translate into normal vectors of light-like geodesic planes. The only difference is, of course, in higher dimensions, there is not really a volume formula for n-dimensional hyperbolic ideal tetrahedra or something, so all these things get more complicated when the dimension gets higher. But in principle, one could look at higher dimensions, and maybe this can be useful for some applications in three or higher dimensional gravity. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Katrin. So there's a tradition that we ask first for questions from students.
Thanks for the talk. So I have a question about the mapping class group actions. What are they doing? What is the interpretation of these actions that are connected?
Sorry, I didn't understand you acoustically, the second part of your question. So I understood mapping class group actions.
Yes, I'm asking about what's the interpretation of these actions. What are they?
Why they're important?
Yeah.
So from the viewpoint of gravity, they're important because they're diffeomorphism symmetries. So the mapping class group. So here we have always assumed globally hyperbolic. So we're looking at a two-dimensional surface oriented, and then the mapping class group of the surface is the orientation preserving diffeomorphisms of the surface up to the diffeomorphisms that are isotopic to the identity. And this is kind of the symmetries of gravity, so it's the diffeomorphism symmetries, and the upper part are kind of all the symmetries, and here I'm dividing out those that are kind of infinitesimally generated. So with the ones that are infinitesimally generated, it's clear it's kind of a gauge symmetry, and this is what is the remainder of the diffeomorphism symmetries. So these are precisely the diffeomorphism symmetries that are not infinitesimally generated. So that from the physics perspective, one can also see it if one wants to think in terms of a triangulation or something. I can describe all kinds of things on a surface I can describe by picking subtriangulation. So generally, often one asks that this is ideal, but one describes this in terms of a triangulation. And then, of course, I can define all kinds of things, but then always the question will come up, well, does it depend on the triangulation, on the choice of the triangulation, or does it only depend on the underlying surface? And if you have a triangulation, then you know that the mapping class group action is given by this kind of flip move that I've shown. And any two triangulations of the surface that have the same number of edges and vertices, I mean, this is what you expected, if your morphism will not change the number of vertices, they're related by finite sequences of such moves up to some relations. And this is kind of like the discrete picture that belongs to this. So this describes kind of a non-trivial diffeomorphism symmetry that you cannot easily gauge out, and that kind of comes back in the question of triangulation dependence. And this is basically why it's important. It's also important in Teichmüller theory, basically for the same reasons. You can also see it from a picture when you want to think in terms of you have surfaces and then you have some sort of transitions between different surfaces or cobordisms, and you could think of the mapping class group as something like the kind of simplest examples of that are non-trivial, where you go from one surface to itself, but you go to it in a non-trivial way. That is not just like an identity map, but it's a different map.
More questions from students? Okay, so we move on to non-students. Not up here. Thank you for your very nice talk. There was this formula for the volume of the light-like
tetrahedra, which reminds me of another formula in the sense that it looks like a localization formula. This, when you had this sum over, you had a sum, and inside the sum, you had these Bernoulli numbers, and then powers of alpha and beta. So it's a bit like a localization formula on the edges. You could view it like that, which is similar to, so it raises a question, have you thought of, this was a continuum volume, have you thought of a discrete volume? So kind of, so this is reminiscent of Euler-Maclaurin type formulae, which relate the discrete volume. So you put a lattice to the continuum volume, which have been looked at on classical polyhedra, so not the ones you're looking at, which have the same feature, localization feature, that I am asking.
So thanks for pointing this out. This is something that we were thinking about also about the localization. One way, so we don't fully understand that, but we thought something that maybe goes in the same direction. I mean, one can look at the 3D gravity also formulated as a Chan-Simons theory. And then basically the isometry group of the spacetime needs to be the gauge group of the Chan-Simons theory, but then there's one other choice, and this choice is the ad-invariant symmetric bilinear form, often called trace, to define the Chan-Simons function. And we think that these two, they always have these kind of dual spaces, have the same isometry group, but they're still not the same spaces. And we think this has to do with the choice of this ad-invariant symmetric bilinear form. And that one, if one could kind of have an extended picture, we don't understand precisely what this looks like. One could maybe formulate this in terms of a Chan-Simons theory, then kind of trivialize the gauge field on some patches, and then kind of put all the non-trivial information on the edges, like on the transition between different patches. So we think that what you are saying is precisely something like that, but we cannot kind of derive it in a full formalism or something. So we have the intuition it should be something like that, but it's very hard. And the only way I see where one could give a kind of a really, to derive it in a kind of nice and unified framework is maybe if one uses the triad and the spin connection and one tries to work with from the Chan-Simons picture or from the Cartan formulation of general relativity. But this is, and there are some results on kind of trivializing the gauge field and putting data on the edges and on so on. But it's very hard. So we simply don't know this at this point, but we think it's kind of something we should know eventually, or we would like to know eventually.
So I want to make sure I understand what you said about the mapping class group. So you start with a triangulation of a Riemann surface, for example, is that right?
So and we then, look at, this is an ideal triangulation, yes. So basically we say that at the points here of the triangulation there are cusps, if one looks at Teichmüller space.
Okay, they're cusps, okay. But then you act on that set of triangles and edges and so on with an element, a non-trivial element of the mapping class. That gives you a different set of curves than the manifold. Are you saying that you can always find some particular representative of that diffeomorphism class, which takes it into the same triangulation except for one of these flips? Is that the statement?
No,
Several of the flips?
No, the statement is that the mapping class group action, so you consider only a triangulation and one that is combinatorially the same.
Yeah.
So if I just flip one of these edges, it's no longer the same triangulation. I have to have the same kind of combinatorially the same triangulation. That we can describe every element of the mapping class group as a sequence of flips, a finite sequence of flips. And there are some relations between them.
A finite sequence of flips.
Yes.
That's a statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is also, like, you can be more explicit. You can, for example, realize Dehn twists as flips. For example, if you want to look at a torus or a genus 2 surface and you're interested in the Dehn twists, You can give a sequence of flips explicitly that makes you realize a certain Dehn twist. But it must be the same combinatorial graph. And if I just flip one of these edges, it's not the same combinatorial graph. It's like a groupoid, and the mapping class group is the automorphisms of one object. So the objects are graphs, and the morphisms are sequences of flips, and you're only interested in the automorphisms.
And then I have just a comment. You said something about there are no angles for null, no dihedral angle between null spaces. But it turns out that in a certain sense there are, and it's used in, you can relate it to the boundary term for Einstein-Hilbert action for a region with partially null boundary. And I can explain you about it later.
Is this related to Horow cycles in some way?
Not to my knowledge, but I know almost zero about Horow cycles.
So I mean, Horow cycles is in hyperbolic space. When you look at the two-dimensional hyperbolic space,
well,
is it
disk.
Horow cycles is like circles of this length, and then you can, for example, if you have a light, like if you have a geodesic that goes here to the boundary, or here you have.
I see. No, I mean, what I'm saying is to do with flat angle, you know, flat space time. I don't know if it has generalization to the anti-de Sitter.
Okay, we should discuss this. Maybe
but I would think it's a local idea, the angle, so it should still work. But we'll
is it related somehow to rescaling these light-like vectors in a fixed
yes,
way?
Yes, it is related to that.
Yeah, then it's related to Horow cycles.
Okay.
Okay, so let's thank Katrin.